Welcome to episode 1486 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day, based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In the previous episode, Salome told the story that no mother expects to tell, the death of her firstborn son. Years after Pentecost, James had become a powerful witness in the Jerusalem church. His old intensity redirected toward proclaiming the risen Christ. According to early Christian tradition, his ministry eventually carried him far beyond Jerusalem before he returned to the city, where Herod Agrippa ordered his execution. Another tradition preserves a final glimpse of the transformation Salome had watched for years. The man who once wanted to call down fire on those who rejected Jesus offered peace and forgiveness to the very man whose accusation had helped send him to his death. James had finally drunk the cup Jesus promised he would drink. For Salome, however, martyrdom was not an inspiring story viewed from a safe distance. It was the death of the boy who had raced into the lake every morning, the son whose impatience had matured into courage, the man she had watched become everything Jesus had seen in him from the beginning. Her faith survived his death, but not untouched. The resurrection remained true. Only now, it carried the weight of having to sustain her through the loss of her own child. But Salome had another son. John had lost not only his brother, but the companion against whom he had defined himself since childhood. And what happened to him afterward surprised even his mother. Acts of the Apostles, Part 6, Chapter 6.
John never called himself the beloved disciple. He referred to himself, in the gospel he eventually wrote, as the disciple whom Jesus loved, always in the third person, always at a slight angle from himself, as if the fact of being loved by Jesus was something he could only look at indirectly, not false modesty, something more careful than that, as if he had decided, very deliberately, that the most important thing about his story was not himself, but the love that had sought him out, and what that love had done to him. I am his mother. I have watched him from close range for many decades. And I want to tell you what I saw when I looked at my younger son, not the apostle, not the beloved disciple, not the author of the gospel and the letters and the visions, the person, what he was made of, what the years did to him, what he became after his brother was gone.
As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love.
My mother will tell you what she saw in me. I can only tell you this. Whatever I became because I was loved by him.
There is a way of listening that is different from hearing. Hearing takes in the sound and processes it and files it. Listening receives it, holds it, turns it, allows it to work on you before you decide what to do with it. John listened the way very few people listen. He had that quality from childhood. I described it in the first episode, the boy who went quiet when something had real weight in it, who looked at the middle distance while everyone else moved on, who said the one thing much later that showed the question had been more interesting than anyone knew. That quality did not diminish as he grew. It deepened.
This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you.
What Jesus did with John, I came to believe, was not add something new to him. It was pour something into a vessel that had been shaped precisely to receive it. John's particular quality of attention, his capacity to hold something in its full complexity without forcing a resolution, to sit with a mystery rather than domesticate it into a manageable truth, that capacity became, in the years of following, the instrument through which the deepest things were received and eventually transmitted. The other Gospels tell you what happened. John's Gospel tells you what it meant. Not instead of what happened, John is meticulous about events, but underneath and around and through the events, the meaning that the events were carrying. He could do this because he had spent 3 years listening at a level that the events were happening on, not just the surface where they could be witnessed and reported. He was at the Last Supper. All four Gospels place him there. But only John records that he was reclining next to Jesus, that Peter had to ask him to find out who would betray them, that when he leaned back to ask, Jesus told him. That proximity was not given to John arbitrarily. It was given because Jesus knew what John would do with what he heard, hold it, turn it, eventually write it down in a way that the world would be reading 2,000 years later, sounds of Golgotha. He came back to the cross. I have said this before and I want to dwell on it now, because I think it is the most important single fact about John outside the pages of his own gospel.
Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify!
The 12 had run, every one of them, including James, including Peter, including the ones who had been loudest about their willingness to die with him. They had all run, and John came back.
Father, forgive them.
I do not know exactly what brought him back, whether it was love that overrode fear, or whether his particular quality of attention simply could not leave the most important thing he had ever witnessed incomplete. Perhaps both. Perhaps they are the same thing. In someone built as he was, he stood there, he watched, and Jesus looked down and saw him, and saw Mary, and gave them to each other. I have thought about what Jesus was doing in that moment, not only the practical provision for his mother, though it was that, something more. He was giving John a mother, not to replace me. I was not dead. I was not gone. John still had me and knew it, but a different mother. The one who had said yes to the angel before he was born, who had kept things in her heart, who had known what he was before anyone else did, and had watched every step of the journey without comprehending it fully, and had loved him through the not comprehending. Jesus gave John the woman who knew most completely what it cost to love Jesus, as if he were saying, "You, John, are the one who can receive this. You are the one who can hold her alongside the grief and care for her and let her presence be part of what you carry into the years ahead." He was right. John cared for Mary until she died. And what he received from her in those years, what it meant to have lived with the woman who had known Jesus longest and most intimately of anyone in the world, I believe that is in the gospel too. The particular tenderness of John's account of Jesus, the sense that the person being described was genuinely and specifically known. Mary was in the room while John was writing.
"These followers of the way are becoming a problem. We must find their leaders and get rid of them."
I want to tell you what happened to John after his brother died, because it was not what I expected, and it tells you something important about him. I expected grief. James and John had been each other's most constant companions for their entire lives, first in the boat, and then on the road, and then in the Jerusalem community. James was the one John pushed against to know where he stood. James was the urgency that John's depth needed to remain tethered to the present. The grief was real. I'm not saying it was not. But what surprised me was that John did not diminish after James died. He expanded, as if the pairing had been necessary scaffolding, and the building it supported was now complete enough to stand on its own. As if some of what had always been inside John, the depth, the capacity for slowness, the willingness to hold things for years before naming them, had been held slightly in check by the urgency of his brother's company. And now that the check was gone, it came into its full expression. He began to write. Not immediately. John was never immediate. But in the years that followed, the gospel came, and the letters, and eventually visions. He had been holding all of it since the first afternoon on the Jordan, since the supper table and the cross, and the empty tomb and the charcoal fire on the shore. He had been holding it for decades, turning it, listening to it, waiting until he was sure of every word. The thunder, in the end, became something quieter and more permanent than thunder. It became the word that was in the beginning. It became, "Love one another as I have loved you." It became the light shining in the darkness and the darkness not overcoming it. That is my son. That is what the years made of him.
John's transformation reminds us God does not form every disciple in the same way. James's faithfulness eventually led him to the sword. John's required him to remain, to remember, to care for Mary, to carry grief across decades, and eventually to give words to what he had spent a lifetime understanding. One brother's witness was completed quickly and violently. The others unfolded slowly across a long life. Both were called to faithfulness. There is something especially beautiful in what became of John's thunder. The young man who wanted his enemies consumed became the old man who would write, "Let us love one another." Transformation did not make John less passionate about truth. It taught him that the deepest truth he had encountered was the love of God revealed in Jesus. Some of God's most important work in us happens slowly. Experiences we do not yet understand may need years before their meaning becomes clear. Grief, failure, love, scripture, and memories of God's faithfulness can remain within us until he is ready to make something of them. John teaches us not to rush that work. Listen deeply. Hold what God has given you. Remain faithful long enough for it to mature. Thunder lasts a moment, but a life surrendered to Christ can leave words that continue speaking long after the sound has faded. To be continued.